This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words Radio, where it's our ambition to move beyond simply talking about Christianity to living more like Christ. Yes, this is the Christ who walked in a small territory of the Middle East. The area, you think of Bethlehem and the region of Jordan, where he was baptized, and around Nazareth, and all these areas. Some of you have been to the Middle East to visit, and you wonder, how do those things that happened thousands of years ago affect us today in our lives? And we have with us, if I could think of anybody I'd want to talk about this, it would be this guest, Dr. Charles Dyer. Charlie's Old Testament scholar and well-known authority on the Middle East and its history and geography. He's a licensed tour guide to Israel. He's traveled there for the past 25 years, leading 70 different trips throughout the region, including Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Greece, Turkey. He's a prolific author. He's written many books. I've enjoyed his books, but especially what has just come out most recently, The ISIS Crisis. And if you, as a follow-up to this program, want to know where to start, you might grab this book off the internet or go to your local bookstore, The ISIS Crisis. Charlie, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's great being with you.
Do you believe that what happened 2,000 years ago when Christ walked the earth really does have effect for us today beyond just simply something we can learn from history?
Oh, absolutely. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, you just look factually, the entire history of the world, not just the Western culture, but the world, was impacted by the events that happened in that small spot of land in the time of Jesus. Beyond that, it goes back to the time of Abraham. And you see the impact that Israel had and God's call of that nation on world events. And then you look at today, and the followers of Jesus still see that reality happening in their lives. And we're seeing change in the world for good because of what Jesus did, because of that event in the Holy Land. You know, it's amazing to us. We view things, you know, size matters in America. Now, bigger is better. And I find it so interesting that God used one of the most, from a geographical perspective, small, out-of-the-way areas, greatest work in this universe.
Personally, I've only been to the area where Jesus lived and walked one time in my life last year. And it was life-changing to see how much evidence there is of what happened more than 2,000 years ago and how it does affect our lives today. And I'm amazed to think of how many times you've been over there. Yeah, so let's move to the kind of things that really strike people's, maybe their hearts with fear. As you wrote the book, The ISIS Crisis, you make the point in the book that if we don't understand our history, we're going to really mess up today as we go forward. Can you reiterate that whole concept?
Yeah. You know, Americans, historically, we're terrible at history and geography. You know, we could barely find places in the Middle East until these events explode, and we don't know our history. For the average American living today, Vietnam and the Vietnam War is ancient history, and yet it was just very recent. We know nothing about World War One, and yet World War One and the impact of it is what actually made the Middle East what it is today. We just had the 100th year anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The average person says, "I never heard of it," but that agreement is what created the countries of Syria and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Jordan. They didn't exist as countries in the sense that we understand them until 100 years ago, and they drew those lines without any understanding of the religious divisions that were there, the ethnic divisions. They created the recipe for the disaster that we've been experiencing. So to the extent we know history and the extent we understand geography, we can understand why things are happening that the rest of the world seems to be clueless about.
You know, it was fascinating learning for the first time as I read your book how it was that back when that agreement was made following World War One, first of all, that the way that the British and the French were trying to parse up the world, violating other agreements. Can you explain that?
Well, yeah. In fact, in World War One, and the U.S. president had said, we should believe in the right of self-determination. Groups have the right to determine their own destiny. The Ottoman Empire had been over the Middle East. But the British and French came in and decided that's all well and good, but we need oil. And the best way to do that is to make sure that the Middle East becomes very profitable for us, very subservient to us and our desires. So they literally drew a line from the Ianaco up to the area of Mosul, and north of that was the French influence. So Syria and Lebanon speak French. South of it was the British influence, which is why next to Arabic, the language is English. But their goal was to reach the oil fields. France wanted the oil fields near Mosul. Britain wanted the oil fields in southern Iraq because they were just modernizing their navies, modernizing their whole understanding as we moved into the 20th century. And their goal was to create a Middle East that would be easy for them to control so that they would have access to the oil. And nothing is new under the sun in that sense, is it?
No. And yet part of the history that people need to understand if they want to know, where did this ISIS crisis begin? You point out so well, it goes all the way back to that period, even to those treaties, when on the one hand, a major problem, I'd like you to speak to this, was that promises, as they were dividing up land, promises were made to both the Israelis and the Palestinians that then the French and British were pretty much planning to forget about. But what they did essentially was stuff people into a region and just give us a little more of that background.
Yeah, three major agreements were made at the end of World War I. And the one was a promise that was made by the British High Commissioner in Egypt to the Arabs. And in essence, he said, join us in the revolt against the Ottomans. And when it's done, we will give you your kingdom. The Arab nation will have its leader. He promised it to the Sharif of Mecca. And they understood it to mean, you get all of the Middle East. It'll be, you know, the Arab nations will become an Arab entity. At the same time, they made a promise to the Jewish people. His Majesty's government looks with favor in the establishment in Palestine of a homeland for the Jewish people. For 2,000 years, the Jewish people had wanted to come home. Many had been living there, but they came along and said, we understand it is your historic home. We're giving it to you. Well, the land they promised to those two groups was, in many ways, the same land. And then the third agreement was the Sykes-Picot Agreement, where it was secret. They didn't want people to know about it, and it in essence said, no matter what we promised others, let's work this out so that you're going to control this area, we'll control this area. And they were really carving it up for themselves for the oil. So that's what created so many of the conflicts we've seen from that day. Some call World War I the war to end all war. And one fellow labeled the peace that was done afterward, all these agreements, he said they were able to create the peace to end all peace. And it's from the end of World War I till today, it's just been a hotbed in many cases because of what the British and French did.
And what we don't understand, and again, I want you to help give our listeners a little better understanding, is how they then created Iraq and many other nations with these straight line borders being completely, it seemed, oblivious to the ethnicities and the ways that people saw themselves divided, not by state lines, thereby really creating so much of the conflict we have today in the Middle East.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, if people want to test this, all they need to do is pick up a map of the Middle East and look at all those straight lines between Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Syria, and ask themselves, where else in the world do you have such straight boundaries when you ignore rivers, you ignore mountains, you ignore geographical natural boundaries, but more than that, they ignore the religious and ethnic boundaries. So Iraq today is one good example. It was actually three different provinces under the Ottoman Empire. The southern part of Iraq was Shiite. The central part, what we have heard called the Sunni Triangle, Baghdad in that region was Sunni, and then up north where ISIS is now Mosul, which was ancient Nineveh, was the area where the Kurds were. We came along, or the British and French came along, made it all one country, and didn't realize they had two different religious groups, the Shiites and Sunnis, who've been at war, and you had two different ethnic groups, the Kurds and the Arabs, who are at war. In fact, the largest ethnic group in the world that was never given its own country is Kurdistan. And the Kurds, part of them are in Turkey, part are in Syria, part are in Iraq, and part are in Iran. And that's a recipe for disaster because they wanted that self-determination they were promised and were never given it even till today.
And then it's fascinating to see how you point out so well that the conflict we find in with the Jews and the Palestinians through this past generation, it goes back, but it goes back well before Israel was established as a state. And And again, people tend not to understand this. Can you help our listeners know a little more about this history?
Yeah, and you mean in terms of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians?
And the Palestinians. We tend to say, if Israel hadn't become a state, we'd have no problem.
Yeah, and the reality is that the people who say that ignore that the Jewish people were there, they were there from the time of Abraham. They were there up to the time of the Romans. It was the Romans who practiced ethnic cleansing and tried to push the Jews out of the land. They were still there, though. In fact, there was a second Jewish revolt 100 years after the time of Jesus, and that's when Hadrian, the Roman emperor, decided, we're going to rename this place. And he said, I don't like the Jews. I don't like the Jewish people. I'm going to call it Philistine land. He named it Philistine land, Palestina. That's where the name Palestine came from. But it was always a geographical term. It wasn't a reference to an ethnic group. In fact, anyone living in the geographical region of Palestine was a Palestinian, including the Jews. The Jewish newspaper, the Jerusalem Post, was originally the Palestine Post. But you had the Jews living there. By the late 1800s, about 50% of the people in Jerusalem, more than that, the majority were Jewish. And then there were Arabs and Christians and others making up the rest of the population, but it was Jewish. When the land was promised to these two groups of individuals, certainly the Jewish people felt that they had a right to the land. It was theirs historically. They've lived there for the past 2,000 years. Every year they would announce next year in Jerusalem. Their religious desire was to go home. You know, the conflict is a millennium in the making, but it was giving the Jewish people something. In fact, ultimately, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is a religious conflict. And the issue is, whose God is God? You know, is it the God of the Bible or is it the God of Islam?
This is important for us to understand, isn't it? Because when we see how ISIS evolved out of the soil of a long history of divisions and the conflict in the center of everything with the Jews and the Islamic nations, that has got a long history. It helps us realize, well, we're part of a continuum. It's not like this is necessarily the end. In fact, you mentioned, well, let me bring it to you as a question that you address in your book. Is this ISIS crisis leading us to the end of time? Will the Antichrist, for example, come out of Islam? This kind of question.
Yeah, and you know, there are some really good Bible believers who right now say they're looking at a parallel between ISIS and the Antichrist and see an Islamic Antichrist and the end times book of Revelation being fulfilled with the Antichrist being Islamic. I don't see that. I don't want to get into too esoteric of details because I can bore people to tears. But I do know this, that the Antichrist, when he comes, it says they're going to worship him. He's going to claim to be God. And I also know in Islam that the fundamental belief of Islam is that there can be no God but Allah. And their problem with Jesus is that he claimed to be God. So I can't see them following a leader who claims to be God in the flesh. There are some other issues, some details in the Bible and the prophecies that don't fit with an Islamic Antichrist. However, having said that, I think God is using ISIS and the other turmoil in the Middle East to shape the world into the form he said it will be in when the end times start. And the one prophecy I keep going back to is Ezekiel 38 and 39, this picture of a nation from the north, Gog from the land of Magog, from an area north of the Black Sea, which is where Russia is today. And it says he's going to attack Israel and he's going to bring along Persia, Cush, and Put, and Togarmah. Persia is Iran. Togarmah is where Turkey is. Cush and Put were the countries south and west of Egypt, that is Libya and Sudan. Well, all those other allies have one thing in common, Islam, and an Islam that tends to be very radical. Russia is trying to build those relationships with those countries and trying to play a bigger role in the Middle East. I think we could be seeing the stage set for Ezekiel 38 and 39 at some point. In that case, I do see ISIS and everybody else playing into God's ultimate plan.
Yeah, so if we, instead of fearing ISIS, fear God, we can find faith to get through all that is coming our way. Do you find, as you do a lot of speaking, and you've written a lot around these topics as they relate to the end of time, do you find people living in fear? And speak against that for us. As Christians, if we've got fear, I don't think that's biblical.
Oh, it's not. In fact, perfect love casts out fear, we're told. And one of the biggest concerns I have right now is that Americans are so fearful. The news is if it bleeds, it leads, is their process. Mm-hmm. So everything is crisis. And they've presented ISIS in such a way because ISIS has made good, quote, press. It helps sell newspapers and advertising time. But it's created people who are fearful. And we need to recognize that God's in control. Even when there's wickedness in the world, God is still in control. He still works all things together for good. And we can live our lives without fear. We also need to remember that our warfare isn't against flesh and blood. It's against the spiritual forces. That what we're really seeing is a spiritual battle that's been going on for the history of this universe. And God has given us the armor to withstand it, mentioned in Ephesians 6. And he's given us prayer. And he's given us the sure hope that we know our eternal destiny. And all of those things can help us. In fact, ISIS right now, what we need to recognize is they need Christ. These individuals need to understand that. And the greatest revival is taking place in Muslim countries now. There are more Muslims coming to faith now in the last 30 years than in the previous 1,400 years combined.
Yes, God is really using this crisis to turn people to Christ. It's amazing the stories we hear, and I bring guests in the radio program about so many. We just had a guest on who was a convert from Islam and who's bringing the love of Christ over the radio waves. And so if you're just tuning in, listeners, we have with us guest Dr. Charles Dyer, and we're looking somewhat at a book I recommend to you, The ISIS Crisis. And there, Charlie, you talk about how you connect the dots back to World War I, all the way through time, and all the different uprisings through Islamic extremist groups, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And, you know, we recognize all these names, and we think ISIS is the ultimate. But you point out that, well, something else is beginning to happen. And even since you wrote the book, much has happened. So give us a little update. Where do you see things heading?
And that's, again, it is so important for us to remember those dots that if people go back to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, they can trace from there. That's where Osama bin Laden really got started. It was when the U.S. then invaded when we went into Saudi Arabia to stop Saddam Hussein's invasion, that Al-Qaeda got its wings. Out of Al-Qaeda, from the second Gulf Wars, where the ISIS grew up, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which became ISIS. But yeah, we need to be, instead of looking backward, be looking ahead. It is interesting. ISIS is being, in one sense, rolled back. They've lost territory in Syria and in Iraq. The Western groups are boxing them in, the Russians and the Iranians and some of the local Syrian forces and Iraqi forces. However, ISIS is breaking out in other places. It's in the Sinai Peninsula, in Egypt, in Libya, the northern part of Africa. So in one sense, ISIS is becoming more diffuse. It's going to always be around, but it's going to be less of a focal point only because the press won't have Syria and Iraq. I think eventually you're going to see ISIS contained there. Not this year, but contained. Now, here's the problem. What comes after ISIS? That's the answer we don't know. And I believe you're going to see more chaos in that region than we've had even in the last several years because of the Sunni-Shiite split, because of the Kurdish desire for homeland. We've been so intent on focusing on ISIS, we really haven't been addressing some of the even more significant questions. What ought the Middle East to look like? Should there be a Syria and Iraq? They didn't exist 100 years ago. You know, would it be better to have a country of Kurdistan and a Shiite country and a Sunni country and an Alawite Druze country? It might have to be carved up into smaller countries that fit the ethnic and religious desires of the people. If we want to have peace. Unfortunately, neither the U.S. nor Russia nor Iran want that. They all have different designs. And so as a result, I think we're going to end up seeing a greater conflict between the major powers of the world. And that goes back to Ezekiel 38 and 39.
You point out, well, historically, what happened to us in Vietnam with Russia back in the regime there. And then we come to Afghanistan and kind of see it in reverse. Maybe just touch on that to give our listeners a sense that we have a lot more to play in the Middle East, a lot more happening than just those local powers of Islam. It's the rulers, the nations, the powers of the world are fighting also on that turf.
They are. In fact, you go back into the 1800s and they had the great game, they called it, between the British and the Ottomans and the Russians in that same region. This region has been fought over, well, from the time of Alexander the Great. So it's been coming for quite a bit of time. But Russia tried to invade Afghanistan, and they were really pushing down, threatening the oil supplies of the Middle East. So Russia in 1979 invaded Afghanistan, threatening the oil fields of the Middle East. At least that's what they were thinking they were doing. The U.S. had pulled back after Vietnam. Russia was going to try and expand. And they ran into a buzzsaw. They ran into the Islamic fundamentalists who didn't want godless communism. And they began bleeding Russia dry. Russia had the superior weapons, but they couldn't always use them in such rugged land. And these Islamic extremists, Islamic fundamentalists, really took them on. And then, of course, the U.S. Supplied those Islamic extremists with some of the most sophisticated weapons, the portable anti-aircraft weapons that were so effective. We called those the Afghan Freedom Fighters. Mm. Their official name was the Mujahideen. And people didn't realize at the time, but the middle part of that word was jihad. They were fighters doing jihad. They were jihadist fighters, and we supplied them with the weapons. So in one sense, we helped create the Sunni brand of Islamic fundamentalism that then morphed from there into Al-Qaeda and eventually into ISIS.
Here we are, and I want to ask the kind of question I think everybody's kind of wondering. As they look at where this is heading, you're saying it might get worse, and it might not be ISIS as the label that we face in the coming days. What are the kind of scenarios you think we might see in our country? Do you feel that with the refugees coming in, that this should be a real concern of ours? Should we be, again, fearful about this?
Well, and again, fearful is the wrong word, but concerned, yes, in the sense that we've already noticed that there have been some Afghans and Pakistanis who are on the terror watch list, who tried to come into the U.S. from Mexico. I think we need to understand that any Islamic fundamentalist group that wants to attack the U.S. Is going to try and use that route into our country. And as a result, I think we do need to make sure we control our country borders in the sense of being secure. I think we got to be careful that we don't become xenophobic, you know, fearful of all outsiders. Because, again, what God has called on us to do is to share the love of Christ with people here, whether they're in our country legally or illegally. Our goal isn't to, as citizens, individuals, to try and be fearful and raise up anger against them. It's really to share the love of Christ with them. God brought them here, and they need to hear the good news that could change their lives. And so I think as individuals, we need to focus on who's my neighbor, as Jesus reminded us, that maybe a person that our country might not like so much or think so much about, but if they're here, we can share the love of Christ with them. That'll make a difference. I think we also need to learn to be really wise. And by that, I mean we need to know what the Bible says the future holds. We don't know all the details, and I get nervous when people try and explain every detail of the future, because we know that we don't know everything. But we have a big picture, and if we take time to read the Bible, we can get a good outline. And so when we see events happening in the Middle East that seem to be setting the stage for that outline, instead of being fearful, we can have hope, because it's just a reminder that we know the God who can move nations and move all the players of the world to set the stage for what he's already said is going to happen, and we know the end of the story.
So we could say this crisis caused by ISIS is pointing people to Christ. First of all, in the Middle East, out of Iraq and so forth, there's in Syria, there's been this refugee crisis that's been unparalleled, going all the way back in Europe to World War II. And this great movement of people displaces them and opens them to new ideas and to the gospel. And so we have opportunity before us. But secondly, the horrific, I hate to say it, Muhammad-like, because you pointed out in your book and others have written on this, Muhammad had many of the traits we see in ISIS today, lopping off heads and so forth. This kind of extreme manifestation of hatred and violence and genocide, this is turning people away from Islam. It is extreme. Not all Muslims behave this way, but it's causing many to open up to Christ. So we have before us great opportunity. But what if there's one person right now, Charlie, who's listening and who doesn't know what we're talking about this faith unto salvation? Can you just close us with a word?
I sure can. And no matter what they've heard about Jesus, what the Bible tells us about Jesus is that he is the Son of God. And by that, he's part of God himself. He was God incarnate, God made flesh. So why would God come to earth? It was because of us. We the Bible says are sinners. That is, we all know that we've lied, we've steal, we have done things that are wrong. To get to heaven, you have to be absolutely perfect. None of us are perfect. So if we can't build a bridge to heaven based on our own effort, God said he would build a bridge from heaven to earth. And that's why he came down to his son Jesus. He lived a perfect life. He showed us exactly what a life should have been lived like for someone to get to heaven. So he had every right to go back to heaven, but instead he went to the cross and he died on the cross. And the reason he died such a horrible death is that he took all of the sin, all the punishment that we should get for everything we've done wrong, and had it put on himself. And when he was on the cross, he experienced the punishment of all people for all ages in that limited period of time. And only a God could do that. And then he rose from the dead. And he said, now I've paid the penalty. I've got a ticket for you to get to heaven. But that doesn't mean that you're there yet. If I buy a ticket for you to ride on the train, until you take that ticket from me, you're not on the train. And so Jesus said, I've paid the price. Here's a ticket, and all you have to do is receive it. And by that, it means just say, Lord, I know I'm a sinner. I know I've done wrong. I know I can't get to heaven. I believe Jesus was your son. He died for my sin and rose from the dead. And Lord, I want to trust him for my salvation. Forgive me because of what Jesus did for me. And when someone does that, that's as simple as it is. They don't have to do anything to get to heaven. They just have to put their trust in Jesus. And God says, when you do that, you're born again. You have an eternal destiny, and you're now one of my children.
Thank you for that, encouraging word. Thank you for your writing, for your ministry, your travel. To the listeners, if you're looking for a trip to Israel, Scripture Awakening, which hosts this program, I'm leading a trip this November. You can just go on our website, and you'll find it there. Dr. Dyer, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great to be with you.
And with you.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. Visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com, where you can download free podcasts of all Beyond Words programs.